From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a doctor's office where, after years of frustrating conversations, a woman named Carol finally received a diagnosis. Carol had spoken with her doctor years ago about her symptoms. Her physician told her that those issues were caused by the stress of being a working mother. Carol was prescribed medication for anxiety. She was sent home. When her symptoms persisted despite the medication, she grew even more concerned. After 2 years, Carol was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. According to the Parkinson's Foundation, the disease affects about 1 million men and women in the United States and more than 10 million people worldwide. While research shows women have a lower risk of developing Parkinson's, there are significant gaps in research and treatment when it comes to female patients. The Parkinson's Foundation has created a new research agenda focused on women. Its goal is to ensure the needs women have when it comes to research and care and make sure those are prioritized in upcoming initiatives. We'll explore that agenda this hour and we'll discuss how women experience Parkinson's disease differently from men. Is that a biological difference? Is it sort of sociocultural? There's a lot to unpack here, and let's welcome our guests. Welcome back to Dr. Michelle Burak, who is a movement disorder specialist and advisory board member for the local chapter of the Parkinson's Foundation. Dr. Burak, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Also with us in studio is Dr. Ruth Schneider, who's a professor of neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center and a movement disorder specialist. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Yvonne Hilton is back with us, a Parkinson's patient advocate, and welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And on the line with us is Megan Feeney, and Megan is a senior manager of community engagement at the Parkinson's Foundation. Megan, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. Well, there's a lot going on here, and I think, you know, for anybody who's listening who either has Parkinson's or has a family member or a friend, you're more keyed into this. But this is going to impact so many more listeners than we probably realize. That's just the reality. And I kind of want to just start by taking the landscape, why we're here this hour, and what we're going to try to work through, because there's some really interesting differences in how we understand Parkinson's, men and women. How are you seeing the current state of things, Dr. Burak?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I am really excited about just some of the research agendas that are coming forward that are focusing on really patient-centered priorities, looking at how we engage people in their the process of you know, defining care goals. And I think this women's research agenda really dovetails nicely with kind of where the field as a whole wants to go.
Our colleague Brett Dahlberg recently reported, talked to Dr. Ray Dorsey at the University of Rochester Medical Center, who said that we're currently in the midst of a Parkinson's pandemic. And, you know, when you look at the numbers, as my colleague Brett Dahlberg reported, the number of people with Parkinson's disease globally has doubled from 1990 to 2015. Absent change, the number of people with Parkinson's disease could double again in the coming 25 years. I mean, that's a lot to get our heads around, Dr. Schneider. Are we starting to get sort of a better idea of what that means and what to do about that?
So that's absolutely correct. I think the prevalence of Parkinson's disease is certainly increasing as the population ages, and this is something we have to deal with globally, but also locally in Rochester here. And it's going to take more resources. So we need more investment from the community, changes in our policies, and more support from the healthcare system.
Megan, how do you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a huge issue, and I think something that's really important to focus on is, while we understand now that there is currently no cure for Parkinson's, it is so incredibly important to focus on people living with Parkinson's today and really focusing on improving and advancing their quality of life. So that was a big, you know, motivator for this entire project and pushing this research agenda forward, was to improve health outcomes for women in the future, but to also offer resources to women living with Parkinson's now.
Yeah, and so let's talk about some of that, because, you know, I admit when I heard Brett's reporting and I heard Dr. Dorsey, it was a little jarring at times. Dr. Dorsey told our colleague that the research on Parkinson's is essentially outdated and that the most effective drugs on the market really don't take into account new developments in technology. And that, you know, of course, last fall, URMC received that multi-million-dollar federal grant to study Parkinson's disease, funding the creation of a new research center. But some of that, Dr. Burak, was a little concerning to hear about, you know, Dr. Dorsey being that blunt about the state of things and what needs to change. It sounds like we're going in a better direction now, though. Yeah?
I think it highlights the challenge that we always face in healthcare, where we are implementing, treatments based on well-designed clinical trials and evidence base, but that evidence base is always evolving. And we learn things that then make us realize we need to go back and kind of look at things with a different lens. And, you know, so are we using outcome measures in those clinical trials that really impact people's lives meaningfully, or are they just things that have been easier to measure? And so the whole field, just in terms of how do we implement best practices in care for Parkinson's, there's a couple of different components to it. There's just the foundational knowledge of what happens when you add a compound or add an intervention to someone's life, but then it's also we're getting better at getting a sense of how that's impacting not just people's physiological function, but also their day-to-day lives. And so two people can have similar level of physical disability, and yet that plays out very differently in their life story based on the context of their life and their environment and their desires and their personal goals. And so we're getting better at acknowledging both sides of that equation.
I think Yvonne's story, which we'll hear in a second, is going to be instructive for us both on the ongoing work that's happening, how she's doing, what we're learning about it. But let me ask our other guests first. You know, before the hour began, Dr. Burak, you mentioned that the difference between men and women as they experience Parkinson's, women are less at risk to get it. I mean, certainly doesn't mean women are not at risk. But in terms of the actual experience of Parkinson's and the gaps in treatment, it's real. But the question of why it's there, is it biological? Is it social in some way? Why are the gaps there? So let's kind of try to walk through what we know about those differences and why we think they exist. I'll start with you on that.
I think we're just looking at the tip of the iceberg of that right now. I think that this initiative really just, you know, kind of looking at what the current state of the research is, going back and getting some dialogue with women with Parkinson's disease. I can just take a simple example. There's a movement abnormality called dyskinesias, where medication that we use to try to help with movement can sometimes overflow with excess involuntary movements. And if you just look at data that's gathered from clinical trials, and then you slice and dice how many women have dyskinesias, how many men have dyskinesias, seems that from these just observations that dyskinesias are more common in women. Now, is that a biological difference? Is there something different about women's brains than men's brains? We know that there are biological differences between the genders, but it could be that women are reporting dyskinesias more because they're more aware of them. So some people find dyskinesias to carry a great deal of stigma, and other people don't really notice them. And so the way we're detecting some of these things, it relies heavily on self-report. And we know that there can be gender differences just in how people kind of view certain symptoms and how they interpret them and how they report them. So I think going forward, we're going to have to look at how are we even detecting these things in the first place, and really carefully, you know, discern, is this a reporting difference or a true biological difference in this specific phenomenon, whichever one it is? And we have motion sensors now, for example, that we're learning to use different algorithms to analyze movement. We can look at sleep, for example. Are there true biological differences in sleep, or are there more self-report differences? Technology can help us discern some of these objective differences and biological differences versus reporting differences.
Okay. Dr. Schneider, can you add to that? How would you describe, generally speaking, whether men and women are experiencing Parkinson's differently?
So I think there are three main differences. So one, as you highlighted, there's a difference in risk. And so we know that men are at higher risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Two is symptoms that are different. And three is care outcomes. So in regards to risk, we don't fully understand why men are at higher risk. Is it related to some inherent differences in the brain? Is estrogen somehow protective? Is it related to different rates of exposure to certain things that we know are risk factors for or protective factors for the development of Parkinson's disease? As far as symptoms go, I would second Dr. Burak. I think there are some things where we have better evidence. So we think that women are more likely to have dyskinesias. We find that women are perhaps more likely to have depression or anxiety. But again, we don't know if that has to do with under or over reporting of symptoms or if there are true biological differences there. And then as far as care outcomes go, women are less likely to receive specialist care from neurologists, which is important because we know that care of individuals with Parkinson's disease is improved by specialist care.
Megan, can you weigh in on that too? What are you most interested in learning as more research and more work is done on these differences?
Yeah, I think you mentioned a really great point about, is this a sociocultural issue? Is it a biological issue? Is it a care issue? And I think a lot of it has to do with the intersection of all of those components, kind of forming together and resulting in these outcomes. And like Dr. Schneider and Dr. Burek were saying, was we have these differences in risk, symptoms, and care. And we know, you know, for example, that women and men with Parkinson's have different comorbidities. And so how are those different comorbidities influencing their long-term care outcomes? And, you know, we know that women are less likely or are more likely to go to doctor's appointments alone. And how is that influencing, you know, later health outcomes? And so this piece about looking at it as a system and acknowledging that there are several different components that are kind of factoring in with these outcomes, how can we really resolve all of, how can we tackle certain pieces of that or all of that if possible to really, again, kind of impact the entire system around it?
I want to talk to you, Yvonne Hilton, about your experience as a Parkinson's patient advocate. And let's kind of remind listeners a little bit more about your background and your story and your diagnosis. Goes far, how far back now?
My diagnosis was I received it in 2007. And you mentioned this, it's a sort of the program, the woman who it took her a long time to get a diagnosis. I did not, fortunately, have to suffer that long. Mine was accomplished in about a year. I started seeing a neurologist. We were living in a different state at the time, and he ran through a battery of tests, and he was not conclusive. He suggested that I go elsewhere, and at that point we came back to Rochester to live, and I went to the Movement Disorder Clinic and received my diagnosis there with the benefit of all those tests that had been done. So it was only about a year that I was wondering what was changing, what was different about me and what I was experiencing. And since that time, I've had the opportunity to really, I guess, get comfortable with it and learn more about what is happening and what could happen. I've had deep brain stimulation, so I have connections that go to my brain and a battery pacemaker in my chest, so that I can that device helps smooth out my movements and gives me more energy through the day. Since we last spoke here, I've had more problems with falling, and my voice is more tends to get softer, and my speech is affected more, and generally I'm doing okay, though. Doing good, doing well.
Tell me about what you hope kind of comes out of the work that's being done here, Yvonne. I mean, you're living this, so what are you hoping for?
I really hope that we can get more women involved in research, participating in research programs. The reason for that is I am certain that there's a hormonal connection. My symptoms invariably get worse with my cycle, and there's absolutely no, or at least very little evidence that that there's any relationship. So it's been somewhat difficult to try to manage that on my own without any research.
You want to add to some of what you just heard, Dr. Burek? I mean, what do we know about, I mean, for example, I've got a question from a listener named Dolores who want to know what kind of estrogen has an effect on Parkinson's. Are we learning at least a little bit more about, you know, hormones and the body and how it could be impacting here?
Some. I mean, I think, you know, as Dr. Schneider was alluding to, the gender differences just in the prevalence of Parkinson's and the suspicion that estrogen may have something to do with that. You know, one of the challenges just in terms of like looking at how symptoms cycle with the menstrual cycle, Parkinson's, the incidence of Parkinson's goes up as age increases. And the majority of women who are diagnosed with Parkinson's, it's after menopause. And so we know less about this because it's just a smaller fraction of women who are you kind of have to have this intersection of women and younger onset to have a group of people that then we can explore, you know, what is happening. We know that things like seizures and migraines and other brain disorders definitely are influenced by the hormonal cycles. But Parkinson's, there's kind of a disadvantage because we just don't, it's not something that we have a high prevalence of in younger age. And so it just takes kind of a little bit more savvy attention to the group of people who are experiencing this and who can teach us what's going on.
You want to add to that, Yvonne?
Yeah, amen. That's one of the reasons that I think, it's one of the reasons I'm sure I became an advocate for Parkinson's. I've tried to educate myself. Sorry about this.
You can get emotional because, you know, we're all friends here, and I want you to feel comfortable, and it's okay, but I know this hits your heart, so take your time. It's okay.
Well, I want to be a resource for other people, not just women, but other people, and I've always had an interest in health, nutrition, wellness, and this intersects well with being mindful, paying attention to your own body, and knowing your own body, what you're reacting to, and how you feel, and how things affect you, and being able to communicate that effectively with your provider. And I feel like that's something I can share with other people. I can try to coach them through that or in that vein. This has been more of a blessing to me than it has certainly a curse. It's given me a purpose, and I tell my husband quite often I wouldn't give it back, but I wish I could talk without crying more often.
Well, I think my observation is it sounds like the emotion is coming from your deep desire to see the progress that would impact not just you, but people like you. And that's what seems to be pouring out of you. So let me try to turn this in a direction that maybe will put a little bit more of an upbeat feel on this. What has worked? What have you learned most that has, because it's been a long 12 years and you've learned a lot. What have you learned most that helps you maybe on a daily and weekly basis?
This may sound sort of Pollyanna-ish, but it's really being able to accept what's happening and live in the moment. They don't make pills for that. You have to do that yourself. And you have to build a community around you that supports you in doing that. And everyone in this room has been part of that. Dr. Schneider is part of my medical team. Dr. Burek has been all along. I've listened to Connections all the time. That's my... Your world gets smaller with Parkinson's. There are fewer things you can do over time. So the radio's on all the time, and your companionship and your brain food, and of course my husband. Without him, my life would be very small. This past year was a significant year for me. Megan's study and the work that she did here in Rochester coincided with a lot of changes that were going on for me. I think most people that know anything about Parkinson's know that exercise is critically important for staving off the progression. And I loved boxing. That was something that I started a couple years ago. And last year, I had to accept that I couldn't do it independently anymore. I have to wear a harness now. And my husband goes with me to class and basically shadows me in case I start to fall. So Megan's work with us made me realize that, well, I knew how fortunate I was before, but it really brought it home, because so many people with Parkinson's don't have a partner, a care partner, so dedicated to help them do these things. So imagine how small their world gets when they can't drive any longer, when they can't exercise the way they have before. And if you're not in a, if you don't have a community around you to help you choose another activity or to help you solve these issues of these losses that you suffer, it's just devastating. And I want to help people that don't have as many resources as I have in terms of community to not feel so isolated, to not feel like it's the end. There's got to be something else.
You want to, yeah, let me turn to her team. Go ahead.
Yeah, if I could just interject to highlight how much inspiration Yvonne has really been throughout this process. So the Parkinson's Foundation approached the University of Rochester, approached us to serve as one of 10 regional forums across the nation. And Yvonne was the first person I thought of to be a co-leader for this as a patient advocate. And so really the development of the forums, participating in the national forums, it's been really an interesting and unique process in how involved the patient advocates have been, and the fact that it's been entirely led by women and really focused on the needs of women with PD.
You want to add to some of what you've heard, Dr. Burek? To me, one of the things that strikes me is when she says there's not a pill for that, just some of the acceptance and some of the, there's a mental health component to this, and Yvonne could probably teach seminars on it. I mean, she's just an amazing woman.
Yvonne is one of the bravest people I know, and she has been my teacher. I mean, I'm struggling not to tear up myself here because I've known Yvonne. She came to me as a patient, but we have grown a very close friendship, and it's because of the wisdom that she's brought and the work. I mean, I want to really pick up on the word you said about community and, you know, what this show represents. But I think one of the things that Rochester does really well is to cultivate community and to emphasize what community does. I've heard you talk on this show before, the research that social isolation has as big of a health impact as type 2 diabetes. And I want Megan Feeney to speak to, yeah, to some of the things that the Parkinson's Foundation is doing and what we've learned from this research project on women and Parkinson's that's going to influence how Parkinson's Foundation supports the community-based aspect. So we think about care for Parkinson's and we medicalize it and we think about what is going on in the clinic. But as Yvonne has taught me and as we're really focusing on in the foundation, there's this whole other piece to it. And you talk about mental health. I even think we medicalize mental health when we talk about depression and anxiety. There is some spiritual and existential and, you know, things that really get at what makes us as people that is not really sent front and center on the research agenda for Parkinson's, and I think it will get there. That's kind of where my career is heading right now, and I think Yvonne, I will just say, has shaped the focus of my research career. You know, I did a PhD in cellular neuroscience. I was tweaking brain electricity with deep brain stimulators and realizing that there's still this gulf in terms of who thrives and who doesn't thrive. And it doesn't have so much to do with what you're prescribing or what you're setting in the brain stimulators. It has to do with that biopsychosocial context in which people are living out the disease. And, you know, the foundation has a lot of focus on what can we do on that other side to support people in community.
Let me turn to Megan Feeney from the Parkinson's Foundation for more on your thoughts and what you heard there from Yvonne. Go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, no, I think Yvonne is able to capture so much by saying so little. And one of, you know, as Dr. Schneider said, we hosted 10 sites around the country to really make sure that we could listen to women from different geographic regions, from urban and rural places, from places with centers of excellence or with resources to places with very limited resources. And within that, we wanted to make sure that each team, each regional team, was co-led by a woman with Parkinson's, so that, you know, we were able to create a sense of, we want to have an honest conversation. And we know that it's not always perfect. And we know that it sometimes can be really, really difficult and really challenging. But at the end of the day, you know, we're here to really hear you. And for a lot of women around the country, I was fortunate enough to be able to attend all 10 regional forums. And this isolation that Yvonne spoke of was so real around the country. It was so real for women to say, I went through this completely alone until I reached out to a women's group, or until I started setting treatment goals with my provider. And then once I realized there was someone else on my team, I was able to advocate for my care, and I was able to advocate for resources and do better and live better. But that time that it takes between that diagnosis and sometimes that delayed diagnosis and actually finding a team that you feel safe and secure with and that you feel comfortable with sharing uncomfortable topics, you know, Parkinson's affects everything. And it can be really, really uncomfortable to talk about at times. But if you're able to find a team that is okay with the discomfort, you really can kind of move forward. And, you know, this research agenda identified 9 priority areas that we wanted to focus on. And as Dr. Burek said, the foundation moving forward has really committed to focusing on 4 of those areas. And so, you know, within the agenda, we're going to continue to focus on research relevance to ensure that, you know, Parkinson's research is relevant to women and understands why, like we talked about earlier, why women are at a reduced risk. We also really want to focus on care communication. And Yvonne has spoken about this to not only other women, but to other providers. She was at a panel session with myself in Phoenix a couple weeks ago, speaking to medical providers across the country about the importance of setting goals in an appointment and the importance of using shared decision-making tools to promote effective communication. And so the foundation is going to be focused on developing those tools now so that women with Parkinson's can better communicate with their providers and really capture the issues that are most impactful to women. The foundation will also be focusing on self-management resources and tools so that women really feel that they can advocate for themselves and they can, if, you know, maybe they don't have a care partner like Yvonne was saying, but still feel that they have the resources and information enough to be able to continue to live a high quality of life given a more limited care team. And then lastly, the shared responsibility piece, the foundation will be continuing to focus on. Across these 10 forums, we very quickly realized that there's really a shared responsibility for not only women with Parkinson's to know about their care, but for people and their non-medical care team, so family and friends and spouses, to really understand what's going on as well, and to also at the same time make sure that they're taking care of themselves. So this is often, you know, the first time that male care partners are very heavily stepping into this partnership role. And we want to make sure that they feel prepared and, you know, as Dr. Burek was talking about, in a positive mental health space to be able to provide and keep this dynamic and keep their partnership really positive while managing Parkinson's. So I know I just threw a lot at you there, but I hope I was able to answer some of those content questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a moment, we're going to get a phone call from Deb who wants to offer some supportive words for you, Yvonne. But before we do that, Dr. Burek, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I want to make a prediction. I think that the outcomes of this research agenda is going to improve care for men and women with Parkinson's, because I think a lot of the themes that we're identifying, I don't know whether women are more discriminating customers, but, you know, many of the things that we're talking about in terms of clear communication and, you know, shared decision-making, you know, those things are relevant for men and women, but they're coming up as a strong theme as we ask women, you know, what is it that they need from the healthcare system?
Do you want to add to that too, Yvonne?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that jumped out from the study was the consistent use of language, a consistent understanding of what medical language is and patient language. For example, what is a fall? How do you define a fall? Does your whole body have to hit the ground, or is it just losing your balance? and it could make a difference in terms of, you know, how serious your balance issues are. I've been comparing intake forms from various hospitals, and one form asks if erectile dysfunction is a problem, and another form asks if you have problems with sexual activity. Well, if you're a woman and you read erectile dysfunction, you might think, well, gee, maybe I'm not supposed to, maybe there's sexual problems that won't affect me, or I shouldn't be, it's not related to Parkinson's. But if it asks the other way, do you have problems engaging in sexual activity, then that applies to everyone. So using language that's not threatening, that's not, doesn't draw conclusions or could have a person think, well, that doesn't apply to me. It's so important. There's an example that I feel compelled to share, following up on something that I think Dr. Brack said earlier about dyskinesia. Women experience the motor symptoms more often. When we were going through this study, there were comments made by some of the women that participated that they felt ashamed. They felt guilty. They had feelings of shame because of Parkinson's. And that was something so foreign to me. I couldn't imagine that as something to, on top of everything else that you're feeling about, you know, the sense of loss and the kind of fear or the things that take over. You feel shame for having a disease that you have no control over. I thought, it was very, very sad to me. And subsequent to that, I heard another woman tell a story that she's not allowed to babysit her grandchildren because of her tremor. Her daughter or her children don't trust her that she has the capability to safely babysit. And I thought, these are such sad situations because they're things that define us. They're some people would wait their whole lives to be grandparents. And to live with those losses, again, there's no pill for that. You can't make that go away for a person, but to build the community, to build all those supports of a team that can provide it. It might be a doctor, it might be a mental health worker, it might be who knows, a support group of some kind, but it's important to just draw those strings together and try to provide what we can.
On the subject of support, let me get Deb in Rochester calling. Go ahead, Deb. Are you there, Deb?
Hi, Evan.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, ladies. I just wanted to say I was listening as I was getting in my car to go get some lunch, and I heard Yvonne on the radio, and I want to just call in and give my support to Dr. Burek and to you, and to thank you for everything you've done to help Frank and continue to do, and you're a great inspiration to us. And just a little bit about the diet thing. I don't know if you know, but we have also changed our diet as of January 1st this year, and we're playing around with paleo, and I don't know, I think it's helping Frank a lot at the moment, and hopefully we'll just continue down a different, you know, eating path, trying to eat clean and trying to avoid dairy and avoid grains and that kind of thing. And I just wanted to thank you for being on the radio, and I don't know, I just wanted to call in.
Well,
thank you, Deb.
Thank you, Deb.
Thank you. Love you guys.
Thank you very much, Deb. I appreciate that. Deb DeBlaise, her husband Frank, is a music culture critic, writer, who's on this program not too long ago. And always enjoy the conversation with Frank. And she's sharing her thoughts on some eating. Have you noticed, and this is purely anecdotal, and the scientists are about to kind of chide me for this, so we don't want to, we're all a sample size of one, but have you noticed food impacting you?
I'm going to say no.
Okay.
But I think I might be an out. We're all different, so I guess we're all outliers. I have been conscious of my diet for quite a while. I was trying to actually figure out what was wrong with me before my diagnosis, and I suspect that I might be gluten intolerant. So I've been mindful of food interactions and food, the results of eating various diets for a while. So I don't have the typical interactions with protein when I take my medication that some people have. The food that I eat is pretty, fairly unprocessed. Good Food Collective is my grocery store. Mm-hmm. I eat meat, but not often. So I think I have a very good diet, and the medication that I've been on has, since the beginning, is still working for me. Just more of it. So, I don't think there's a big interaction, but I think my gut's probably cleaner than a lot of the average person.
Okay. Other guests in the room, Dr. Schneider, Dr. Bjork, thoughts on food?
So I think we need to learn more about the role of nutrition in food and Parkinson's disease. What we can say is that the medications are probably better absorbed in many people on an empty stomach, and that there's a potential for an interaction between protein and some of our commonly used medications. That said, everybody's experience with that differs. We know also that the gut microbiome differs in folks who have Parkinson's disease, and that this may be something related inherently to having Parkinson's disease. It may reflect the treatments that we use for Parkinson's disease. But we don't know yet what to do with that information or how we can impact that.
Okay, Dr. Bjork?
I think nutrition, some of the questions that come up about this is it highlights an area of research that's a lot more challenging to do an intervention study compared to add a certain medication. You can use a placebo when you're talking about diet. What
too,
are you going to compare
variables
it to?
With diet? Is that?
And compliance and, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. sourcing. I mean, even just, sourcing of foods, you're going to get different. So there's just a lot more variability when you're talking about diet than when you have something that the content is highly precisely controlled by a pharmaceutical company.
Sure.
And so some of the gaps in knowledge, it's not that scientists and doctors don't care about nutrition in Parkinson's. It's that the methods that we use for creating generalizable knowledge are harder to apply in something where there's just a lot more variability and a lot more difficult to control.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think about my own. I mean, I'm a migraine sufferer, and just even isolating what we think triggers are is really hard mm-hmm. because you're not just eating avocado that day or mm-hmm. a pineapple or chocolate or red wine or coffee, whatever the case may be, it's really difficult. And so I think it's interesting just trying to isolate and kind of follow the causes. Anything you want to add there, Megan Feeney?
Yeah, I was going to say, so as part of this project, what we did was we did, a landscape review of all the literature that was available. And something we noticed was, in addition to there being limited research on treatments, like traditional treatments like medications or DBS, well, we found that there's also not a ton of research on alternative treatments and whether or not certain alternative treatments benefit women or men differently. And so I think, in addition to participation in research for medications and DBS, there's also a real need for really understanding which treatments, alternative treatments that women might have more control over and really, managing their Parkinson's, making sure that those are benefiting women to, again, these optimal levels.
We've got to get our only break of the hour. And when we come back here, we have some listeners who are wondering, we're talking about how we treat, we're talking about the ongoing research and what we know, especially about the differences between men and women and what we are learning about them as it comes to Parkinson's disease. But some of our listeners are saying, okay, if I'm a woman, should I be looking for different symptoms? Are there other signs or warning signs that I ought to be looking for, either different than men or things that we may be learning early on, even before diagnosis? So we'll have our guests address some of those questions that listeners have raised and a lot more. You just heard Megan Feeney, Senior Manager of Community Engagement at the Parkinson's Foundation. Dr. Ruth Schneider and Dr. Michelle Burak are in studio, and the remarkable Yvonne Hilton as well. So let's get that break and we'll come right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, if you're not a large city in this country, how are you going to build a job base that will last into the future? Ithaca is trying to do that. We'll talk to them about how they're trying to crack the code. In our second hour on Monday, a documentary called Roll Red Roll about a gang rape in Ohio. The film will be screened by the local group Resolve. We'll talk about teenage sexual assault and how to help survivors on Monday. This is Connections, and we open the hour with the story of Carol. The Parkinson's Foundation spoke with a patient and an advocate named Carol, who said, quote, "When I first experienced Parkinson's disease symptoms, they were explained away as just the stress of a working mom. I was prescribed medication for anxiety, and the eventual diagnosis of Parkinson's was not made for another 2 years," end quote. I bring that up because as we talk about understanding the differences between men and women, we have some listeners who are curious about whether they should be looking for symptoms or, you know, this is tough. I mean, Carol's story is tough because you don't want to tell your doctor they're wrong. It's really tough when you get a medical practitioner saying, well, here's what we think it is. But how do you advocate for yourself without sort of questioning the expertise of a medical? It's hard. Let me kind of ask all of our guests to weigh in, and I'll start with Dr. Burek on this. Anything we should be looking for, particularly the women who are listening, in terms of symptoms, signs, maybe some warning signs, or at least questions to raise?
So I don't know that the manifestations of Parkinson's differ significantly between men and women at presentation, other than in these sort of data digests that we're parsing, are there significant differences between men and women? It did actually, surprisingly to me, and I don't know what to make of it, but it seems that tremor is a more common presenting symptom in women. Women tend to be older at age of diagnosis than men. Some of the questions I have about just those observations is, you know, do you have to have the more textbook tremor manifestation to have it accurate? Identified as Parkinson's, and if you have some of the other, you know, less obvious complaints of pain or fatigue, is it more likely for a woman to have those things chalked up to something else, whereas people will maybe have a little bit more savvy for identifying Parkinson's? Same thing with the later diagnosis. Is that a biological difference, or is that because, again, we tend to come up with other explanations, as Carol had, for symptoms in women compared to men? So right now, I don't know of any evidence, and maybe Dr. Schneider has seen something that's different between men and women.
No, I agree with you there. I would say, just to take a step back, you know, Parkinson's disease is typically diagnosed on the basis of motor symptoms. So things like stiffness, slowness of movement, and tremor. But in reality, we recognize that non-motor symptoms are a huge part of the disease and a huge part of living with Parkinson's disease. And there's a lot of research to say that non-motor symptoms are part of the prodromal period, so part of the period that precedes your formal diagnosis. And so things like acting out your dreams or having anxiety, depression, constipation, you know, many of those things are pretty common in the general population. So it's hard to assume that your constipation represents Parkinson's disease. But just to highlight that there are many early kind of non-motor symptoms that can be early signs of Parkinson's disease.
Okay. And another listener brings up that says this topic kind of leads to broader questions about whether serious illnesses or diagnoses are handled as though they only happen to men. Do you agree with that? Is there a risk that the concern raised by the listener may have some merit?
I think the medical system interfaces with women differently. And I think that, you know, there's evidence that if there's a mental health diagnosis on the books, physical symptoms are going to get heard differently, treated differently, you know, worked up differently. And I, you know, this is in other general health complaints, but I can't imagine that the situation would be different in the context of Parkinson's. I don't think that once someone has the diagnosis of Parkinson's that someone thinks it's less legitimate in a woman than in a man, but I think that path to getting that definitive diagnosis, that path to savvy identification of, you know, what is the significance mm-hmm. of symptoms, there's a lot of more opportunities for detours for women than for men, just okay. based on the way the healthcare system interfaces with women.
I agree.
I do. I don't have any evidence, I guess, to support this, but I would say, you know, as humans, we all suffer from implicit bias. And I think that the way we, when we approach an individual patient, we have to keep that in mind, right? So whether that's, you know, we may have a tendency to be more dismissive of complaints from women or take various symptoms differently if it comes from a minority, I think we need to take that into consideration.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair enough. Anything you want to add, Megan Feeney?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think this speaks to a lack of awareness, and that, you know, part of this is due to an awareness issue. And when we, you know, first received the grant award from PCORI, what we wanted to do was look at other health issues and chronic illnesses and what they had done to address women's disparities in their section of health research. And, you know, thinking of cardiovascular disease and how much growth they've made in that area, recognizing that men and women have different symptoms when experiencing a heart attack, really kind of motivated us to you know, bring this awareness that women experience Parkinson's and they have unique experiences with Parkinson's. And so what can we do to really make sure that the healthcare system is reflecting those unique qualities? And so I think raising awareness for and doing things like this to really promote women to ask questions and to go to their doctor, or something Yvonne and others mentioned at these forums was really tracking their symptoms so that it wasn't based on necessarily recall, like having a journal, a daily journal of just how do I feel, what's going on today, and then bringing that in so it's 3 months of information, not just this is what happened and there's no context for your provider. And so I think, you know, this piece of looping other people in and really making sure that you're advocating for yourself is a big awareness issue that we're hoping to address moving forward.
Right, let me get another phone call. Anne in Penfield. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi, I will make this real fast. Two quick things. Within the last few days on NPR, there was a terrific segment that was featuring the National Library of Medicine, which is a division of the National Institute of Health. It's located in Bethesda. And I'd never heard of this, and I thought I was informed. And this is an enormous library collection of all kinds of studies of information. And the best part about this is that it's open, it's accessible to anybody, not only in the United States, but around the world. You can tap into it on an online basis. The fellow who was talking, his name was Jerry something, he said, oh, we have people that stop in all the time, and they have information on ongoing studies. They have lists of pending clinical trials. They have reports of data that's been collected. They have historical overviews of research. They group it into various areas of interest, support groups, alternative integrative medicine, nutrition, neurology. I mean, anything. It's just fabulous. And he said, this guy was just wonderful. And he said, we're so excited. We want people to know about it. And if there's anything we can do to help answer questions, we're delighted. That's why we're here. That's our mission. And he said, the biomedical informatics, I'm probably not pronouncing that right, is their mission, as well as training and I'm turning on more and more people to understanding how to research information and how to communicate it to other people. So I thought, and he said, we love the idea of citizen scientists and, you know, there's no dumb question, all of that. And so I thought, this is great. The National Library of Medicine through NIH. The other quick point, just as a point of curiosity, since Parkinson's is one of the aspects of Parkinson's is apparently a deficiency of dopamine in the brain. I'm wondering if substances like caffeine or Ritalin, which tend to somewhat elevate or stabilize dopamine levels, has that been found to be helpful at all? Do your guests have any info about that?
Okay, caffeine, dopamine. Thank you. Dr. Schneider?
So there is some evidence to suggest that caffeine might be protective as far as reducing your risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Dr. Birick, I don't know if you're aware of any more recent studies looking at use of caffeine as a treatment other than to help fatigue.
So, I mean, I think the important point to underscore here is that dopamine is used in a lot of different circuits in the brain. And what we're looking at is loss of dopamine in the movement circuits. Whether caffeine or Ritalin is sufficient to boost dopamine in the movement circuit relative to your alertness centers and your motivation centers and other places that people you know, use caffeine, for example, to promote alertness, not to promote movement. I don't know of any studies that show that there's a significant benefit of those drugs for movement symptoms. We certainly have had clinical trials that have looked at Ritalin, for example, for fatigue and sleepiness. And we know that loss of dopamine is affecting not just movement, but is contributing to fatigue, to trouble with concentration. And we certainly use those agents. But without the strong evidence base that we have for some of the other dopamine boosting medicines that we use to help with movement.
Okay, Carolyn wants to know real quick, any connection between Lyme disease and Parkinson's?
No connection between Lyme disease and idiopathic Parkinson's disease.
Okay. And I want to close just by asking, Megan Feeney, can you give us 30 seconds on what you're looking forward to in terms of the work and research going forward now? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, we're so excited that we were able to go into these 10 local communities, and we can't wait to continue to push this nationally forward. And then also, like I said, we have a chapter in Rochester, and we have a center of excellence in Rochester, and we're so excited to continue working with the Rochester community and as part of this initiative going forward.
And we will shine a light on what you're learning and what you're sharing with our community. It's so valuable. Some final thoughts from Yvonne Hilton. We certainly wish you the best, and I hope you're doing well. I mean, you're this amazing, inspiring person. I just want to thank, we're not going to cry to finish the program. We've cried enough on this program today. Thank you for being here. And I just want to say, I wish you all of the best going forward. And here's hoping that every time we talk, we've got more good news to share about the work and the research being done. What do you think?
Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. Yvonne Hilton is an amazing person, a Parkinson's patient advocate. We always appreciate the conversation and her team around her. She has so much appreciation, and you've been meeting them this hour. Dr. Michelle Burak, thank you for being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Dr. Ruth Schneider as well. Thank you, Dr. Schneider.
Thank you.
Megan Feeney from the Parkinson's Foundation, thanks for taking the time for us this hour.
Thank you.
All right. So much more to talk about on this. John Andrus is the engineer today. Dolores, the wonderful volunteer. We've got great people who help us out every day. Thank you. And our thanks to Megan Mack, the best producer in Rochester. I'm Evan Dawson. Wherever you are, hope you have a wonderful weekend. And we'll talk with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.